This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanasen, and Noelle Lim. It is precisely 6 minutes, 6 minutes, excuse me. 6 o'clock in the morning, Monday the 21st of September. I kind of got confused by the second ticker. I was like, half a minute past six?
Were you going to say 6 minutes into the work day, work week?
It's not quite 6 minutes into the work week.
Exactly. Either way, you would have been wrong.
Well, precisely. Great start to a Monday morning, guys.
The best start to a Monday morning. We're back in the lab, everyone.
We are indeed. And how is everybody feeling today?
I'm feeling good, actually. A good rest last week and over the weekend. And more exciting news ahead this week.
Yes, indeed.
Ever the optimist, Noelle, looking forward to the exciting news we're going to see this week. I am slightly glass half empty this week, not sure what's going to crop up in the news this week, but we're always prepared to bring you the best and most distilled versions of everything. In fact, we've got a great show lined up for you, as we do every day.
I will only give you one word.
Of course, I wouldn't expect anything less, Noelle.
Of course, I'm a woman of a few words. Deadlines.
Okay, so that's going to be happening in about 10 minutes. And after the 6:30 news, Roshan, can you do it in one word?
I will not do it in one word. we're going to talk
it's
about...
It's a skill, Roshan.
Actually, in particular, 6:30, we're going to take a look at the death of RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And essentially, the political fallout is going to come from that. I think RBG was an advocate for women's rights, for equality in the U.S. for many, many years. She was a Supreme Court justice during the Clinton era. She died last week. This is something we're going to be talking about. It's really sad. And the political fallout is going to be infuriating, in my personal opinion. We'll also be taking a look at the political headlines at 6:45, the local papers and the portals. Some news around the slab that fell from the SUKE highway construction. Really scary stuff.
All right, and with that wonderful start to the morning, do remember, if you want to weigh in on our conversations, you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, though, we're talking about competency traps in companies, so stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Boston with More Than a Feeling, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noelle. So the first story we're looking at this morning is out of BBC Work Life, talking about something called the competency trap. Now, you know, if we talked about examples of companies that might have gone through the competency trap, you'll find them quite familiar. It's names like Kodak, Xerox, basically companies that are synonymous with, at one point, failing to pivot and change with the times and capitalize on new developments in order to keep their position where they were, because they were at one point leaders of their field, right? So competency traps are when companies find themselves almost bogged down by their previous successes to a point where they are not able to dedicate as much time to new opportunities and inventions.
Or sometimes don't want to, right? Because of the successes they are currently going through. Like, the biggest example or the most famous one would be Kodak. I mean, Kodak had the technology for digital cameras way early, but because they make so much money from film, from the actual selling of film cartridges, are they called film cartridges? I can't remember.
Film rolls.
Film rolls. That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you, Noelle, for saving me
so
early in the morning.
Yeah. My little contribution from another generation.
Hey, I used to develop film as well.
Yes.
I got my first camera at 6 years old, and then I was like, and I didn't realize how expensive it was to get photos developed. So I finished an entire roll in like one sitting, and then my parents were not very happy. But basically, let's get back to this situation here. Kodak could have started development of digital cameras way earlier, but they didn't, because a lot of their money came in from the film rolls that they were selling. And now, what is Kodak now? I mean, once in a while, I mean, a few weeks ago, the stock came up because of some talks around vaccine investment. But now it's no one talks about it. The Kodak moment is something that I think younger people will not understand what that means.
Well, you do. So, you know what drives this behavior, right, where organizations miss out on opportunities? Because the performance of a CEO is often measured by the return on investment. And the higher the investment, the lower the ROI that he would generate for the company, at least in the short term. So it really takes a very courageous CEO, especially if the company is listed, to actually make that investment. And he may not actually see the return investments in his tenure as CEO. So that's why you find that some CEOs just don't want to make that investment. And I think secondly, also, sometimes companies don't want to cannibalize their own products that are really doing very well already. So there's always that reluctance. But I think now companies have come to their senses, because if you don't cannibalize your own product, a competitor will, right? So it's better you do it yourself. And thirdly, sometimes management just lack the vision and they lack the ideas and also the skills to, you know, make that new investment.
Yeah, because sometimes it also comes down to entrenched habits, right? Because human beings are creatures of habit and routine. And within a company, it can be the case where, particularly if you're a company, when you start out, you know, you're a company of young 30-somethings, and then 20 years down the line, that company of young 30-somethings is a company of 50-somethings who have achieved a lot of success, but who may not be necessarily as in touch with the demands of a younger generation as they once were. So it comes down to the ability to listen to junior employees as well, and not just to dismiss them out of hand because of a lack of experience, because of a lack of exposure, which is, you know, something that is very prevalent in a lot of societies. And we've seen it a lot in our political scene recently with the talk about the newest political party on the block, MUDA.
Yes, and actually, if you want to learn more about MUDA, we did have a conversation with Syed Sadiq last Thursday. So look that up on the BFM app to get a bit of an introduction to what the party stands for. And it was quite a good conversation. Definitely something you want to check out. But back to this story here. So I think it really comes down to this. We have entered an era. It's also short-termism, right? So every companies are looking at quarterly results as opposed to annual results, and looking at annual results as opposed to decades of change that they can do. And this misaligned motivations and incentives of top management in terms of their stock options and what makes the stock pop as opposed to what's going to make the stock pop in 10 years. That's something that you can only do if you are in a very secure position in your company, right? You have a board that trusts you, you have an executive team that trusts you. And a lot of times that's not the case unless you're someone like, for example, Bob Iger at Disney, right? Bob Iger is no longer the CEO. He's the executive chairman of Disney, but he was probably the most famous CEO since Walt Disney himself. And that's why he pushed the Disney Plus thing. Disney Plus is like the exact same concept, right? It's going to cannibalize the revenues of the Disney Corporation in the longer term. Mm. If you subscribe to Disney Plus, are you going to be subscribing to their other channels, the cable TV, which generates or typically generates revenue? Probably not, but you have to go that way. If not, at some point, Netflix and the other competition that have no high base effect are going to kill you.
Yes. So, yeah, I think that's why CEOs have to be very open, right? Like you mentioned. And also, I think this book, Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen, I think he says that, you know, for innovation to really take place, to not fall into that competency trap that you talk about, you know, maybe new businesses have to be started by new teams who have no baggage from the past.
Yes, indeed. So let us know what you think about this. So we're asking the question of, are you aware of a competency trap in your workplace? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up for you. And then up next, looking at deadline stress. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Funk Factory by Rose Royce, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel.
I wonder where they got inspired from with that name, Rose Royce.
Ah, I wonder too.
Maybe they used to work in the Rolls Royce factory.
Could be. Their debut single was Car Wash, so... Okay, well, this morning we're taking a look at the subject of deadlines because, you know, in the working world, deadlines are an unfortunate, necessary evil. There's always the question of whether or not we can turn these stressful deadlines into motivating factors. And there's an article in the BBC Work Life looking at precisely this, the psychology of deadlines. And it talks about the goal gradient, right? The perceived bang for your buck that you get for every unit of effort you make. So essentially, you know, when you've got like 2 weeks to do a job, you're like, you know, there's so much I could be doing in that 2 weeks. But then as the deadline looms closer and closer, in that last day before your work is due, suddenly it seems like, you know, there's not a lot you can do in one day, right? So you might as well sit down and get to it. And the perception can be that, oh, you know, I'm getting so much done in this one day. It's very, you know, it's very satisfying. You know, it's, you know, it's hitting all of those the buttons that you get from just small units of success. And it can be tempting to just get yourself stuck into this little loop of last minute bursts of work, right? But at the end of the day, it can come with quite a lot of stress.
I think it really depends on how you deal with stress in general, right? So when you have, if you're the type of person who thrives in stress, and there are people who do that, right? The deadline, as you get closer to the deadline, they get more efficient in doing the work, and then they produce a magnificent piece of work in the last hour. But there are some people who need to start very early on, right? I find myself lying somewhere in between that. It's a bit of a mess. If I take a look at, let's just take university, for example. For the subjects that I was good at, even if I did it last minute, I would do well. The subjects where I wasn't good at, I would still do it last minute and not do as well. I still pass, but I wouldn't do it as well. And the same thing would happen for exams. I personally find as the deadline comes in closer, there is more of a push to actually work because that goal gradient thing, because there's less opportunity cost to do other things, and you are more incentivized to, okay, what else am I going to do within this last hour before my exam? Study lah, you know? And now I'm not encouraging procrastination here. In fact, you should be procrastinating when it comes to things like this. Study, because I always regret it. After the exam, I wish I'd done more earlier. But I think one thing that really gets pointed out here is the cons of sitting down for an open-ended session. This is where I always fail. I'll always tell myself 4 weeks from before a deadline, all right, I'm going to start today. But when you sit down and you have such an open-ended task in front of you and you're not sure where to start, that's when the procrastination starts because you're not sure where to begin. And you, even if it's just the best times, I always want to tell myself, okay, today, 10 minutes, you're just going to sit down and think about what you're going to do tomorrow and just write those down. You have to write. You must produce some product from that 10 minutes. And then once you have that direction, then you start really working on those points. And that's when I find most productive and you really hit those deadlines in the end.
Yes, I think when you have a first product to work with, then you can fine-tune it, right? Because the end product can look very different from the first. The point is to get started, right? So I think there are two things for me. If I'm learning something, when I struggled with math, my mother would encourage me and she would say, can you practice 5 questions first? And then can you do another 5 questions the next day? And then once you get started on 5 questions, you actually end up doing 10 questions and then you build another 10 questions. So that's how you just get better, right? But when I realized something, when it comes to more creative work, like writing something from scratch, sometimes you just don't have the inspiration. But maybe this method of just plonking something down on paper and then coming back and to revisit might help. And also, I think this thing about having feedback, right? Getting feedback from people will sort of, keep you going.
Oh my God, I hate getting feedback from people.
Yes, I know, right?
Yeah. I really hate it, guys. Yes.
Are we cramping your style?
No, it's just I have a lot of anxiety associated with a lot of my tasks, right? So I know academically that feedback is a good thing because the more people you show your work, the more perspectives you get and, angles that you didn't consider before. But that, like, hour or 6 hours or a day of waiting for people to respond is the absolute worst. So
I
when we talk about how I change my workflow changed, university is also a good example for me because, I went into first year university, very chill, super last minute. I started studying for SPM like 2 weeks before the first exam. So that was the mentality I went in with and I struggled. By third year, I had been like, okay, I can't do this anymore. I can't pull any more all-nighters. It's just not feasible. And I was, writing my assignments a week, 2 weeks before the deadline. And then the anxiety kicked in. And I would, in the last like 5 days before the deadline was due, I would think, okay, I have to revise this. I have to revise this essay. I have to look at this essay again. What if I find more information? And I just couldn't do it. And I would actually just like, okay, just submit the assignment sight unseen, haven't looked at it in more than a week, and just to get it off my plate, right?
Actually, that's the similar struggle I faced, right? If I did something too early, I didn't want to deal with it later on. But if I dealt with it later, I would be updating till the very last minute. Trying to find that balance is so much easier said than done, but it's a struggle that we are all facing, right? And just a very real world example was that over the weekend, I keep telling myself that I need to put up more of my own content on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all these things. But I've been procrastinating for ages. And then this whole TikTok thing happened. And then Donald Trump said they're going to shut down TikTok on Sunday. And I said, okay, this is the opportunity. I have a deadline because the timeliness of putting this news out is going to be that deadline. And I finally put a video out on Instagram and I was very happy with myself. But it's those deadlines that get things done because if you have an indefinite amount of time, will you really do anything?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to meeting deadlines, it always helps to know what is your bigger goal in life or in your project, right? What you are willing to give up in order to achieve your goal. I think once you realistically know that, then I think you will make that commitment to see it through in a most stress-free way.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's also just finding the practical ways to get around your anxiety and your fears and your unwillingness to confront kind of whatever uncomfortable feelings and feedback, exactly, right?
Yeah, and I think just tying it back to what we were talking about earlier about the competency trap, right? I guess maybe it's this perpetual cycle of deadlines that people don't look at the bigger picture. If you're so concerned about what you have to put out next, you're not worried about what you have to put out 5, 6, 7 steps later.
Yeah, and so, that's when a competitor will just come choke your market share.
Especially when you're coming from a high base effect, right? When you are winning, you want to continuously win in what you're doing, as opposed to if you were just a startup or basically you've been losing, you have nothing to lose by trying something new. So it's that fear of losing.
Exactly. It is really, because when you're at the top of the mountain, right, the only, and everyone is looking to you for the next big thing, and it can be a lot of pressure, and you can find yourself being the one like afraid to fall off the mountain, as opposed to the person on the ground just like, okay, nowhere else to go but up. It's an interesting sort of psychological system surrounding these deadlines. But let us know what you think, how you manage your deadline stress. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news bulletin coming up for you. But first, She's My Baby by the Travelling Wilburys, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Torn by Natalie Imbruglia, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. 6:40 in the morning, Monday the 21st of September, and if we turn our attention to international stories this morning, I think over the weekend we got some sad news out of the US. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is a Supreme Court judge for many, many years, has unfortunately passed away, and I think I saw this explode over Twitter. With many using the phrase "May her memory be a revolution," which I think is particularly potent, considering all that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has done in her life, and the fact that I think she passed away on Rosh Hashanah, which is, if I'm not mistaken, the last day of the Jewish year. So since then, there has been a lot of consideration over who's going to replace her on the Supreme Court. What are the political machinations that are going to go into it? And the Bloomberg has an article here saying that President Donald Trump expects to nominate a replacement for Ginsburg within the next week.
Now, why this is particularly, I mean, it's perfectly within the right of the president to do so, right? And within, I think it's Article 2 of the Constitution or something like that, where the president can nominate one, it goes to the floor, and then either the Senate then decides whether to confirm the nomination or not. The problem here is that this similar situation happened in 2016 during Barack Obama's time. 9 months before the election, Anthony Scalia died. And the White House then, the Obama administration, tried to push Merrick Garland through. Mitch McConnell, who is still the Senate leader today, killed that before it could even reach the floor. So he didn't even get an opportunity to confirm this vote for him. This was 9 months before the election. We're 2 months, a month away, 5 weeks away from the election now. And lo and behold, they're going to push a nominee through. And Mitch McConnell has said it's because the White House and the Senate are aligned, are the same party this time around. But it just reeks of hypocrisy, and it's just political power. But two senators from the Republican side have said that they won't be voting. So that leaves it down to, if another two defect from the party line, we could see this confirmation fail.
This is quite important, very important actually, because the ideological balance of the 9-member Supreme Court is very crucial to its rulings on the most important issues in U.S. law. So right now, if Trump obviously would have a conservative candidate and a candidate who's in favor of, who supports the Republican Party or leans towards the Republican Party, and so that would, I think, make the court a majority conservative membership, right? So
yeah,
I think
it still is, though. though. It's still a conservative majority, 5-4.
Yeah, so that would, you know, lean it more towards the Republican side. And so I think that's where it's problematic. And like you say, you know, just one more month, but Trump is rushing this through, and the Senate apparently will obviously support this.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is that this is more of the political ideology, right? Because we have seen this same Supreme Court, and beyond a 5-4 majority, strike down laws that or executive actions that the White House has taken. And we've seen, whether it's Kavanaugh or Gorsuch, these are two nominees to the Supreme Court, new Supreme Court judges who have voted, who have basically ruled against the White House. So I think the Supreme Court's balance there is something that we need to recognize. But it's the ideology for other things that going forward will be interesting to see. Because a 5-4 balance is still a good one. If it switches over to a 6-3, then we're not sure how that plays out.
Yeah, I think when it comes to looking at the Republican-Democratic partisan fight that is happening in the U.S., we have to remember that Donald Trump is not the Republican Party. It seems like he has become the entire Republican Party over the last couple of years or so. And as, I guess, the Republican Party tries to decide who is going to be their best bet for the presidency. But, you know, even within the party itself, he didn't initially get a whole lot of support when he decided to run on a Republican ticket. He has had pushback from a notoriously toe-the-line community, particularly in the last year or two of his administration. So, you know, it's perhaps no surprise that we should also see his nominees for the Supreme Court, who would otherwise be aligned with the Republican Party, also, you know, at some points push back against some of the a little bit more out there executive orders that he's put forward.
So RBG's granddaughter read her statement, RBG's statement, "My most fervent wish is that I will not be replaced until a new president is installed." And the statement was read to the NPR, National Public Radio.
Yes, I guess we'll have to wait and see for whether that comes to pass. But right now we are heading into some messages, and then up next we're going to be looking at the political headlines here in our own local papers. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Jolene by Dolly Parton, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. Now, we're looking at what's happening on the front pages of our newspapers this morning, as well as our local portals. I have The Star in front of me, and right on top here is higher contagion rate. So this is on the back of a recent rise of clusters in both Kedah as well as Sabah. It appears that Malaysia's COVID-19 infectivity rate has gone up since early this month. But apparently experts are still saying that, you know, how fast the disease spreads still depends on the public health measures that are in place and how effective they are. And I think there's another COVID-19 kind of related article as well in the Malay Mail. Health Ministry is conducting depression tests on frontliners who are involved in helping to curb the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic to try and assess their stress levels and concerns.
Yeah, so I think separately on COVID-19, there was a flight that was coming in from India using Malaysia as a transit point, and a flight that will continue on to Hong Kong. So Hong Kong has temporarily barred that route, Cathay Dragon's KL service and Air India, from flying passengers to Hong Kong after a number of passengers originating from India were tested positive for COVID-19. So if any passengers that were now going to be travelling from Malaysia to Hong Kong using that route, they will have to wait for 2 weeks, or I think they will have to get some compensation from the airlines. So I think there's going to be a 2-week wait, and this will be quite unfortunate if there are some students who happen to be taking that route to Hong Kong to go to UK or the US.
And I think some of the big news that we heard over this weekend is that EPF released its numbers as well for the second quarter. And a total, if we take a look at the numbers, the retirement fund reported a gross investment income of 15 billion ringgit in the second quarter of 2020. That's up 24% compared to the first quarter of 2020 of around 12 billion ringgit. If I take a little bit of a look at some other previous reports, in the second quarter of 2019, its gross investment income was around 12.3 billion ringgit. So it is slightly up on a year or year over year basis. And a total equity value of EPF stocks increased about by 27 billion ringgit since the end of the first quarter, and totals around 155 billion. It decreased its shareholding in 62 stocks, while it increased its stake in 111. And really, I mean, all in all, quite a good set of numbers, I think. But we'll be taking a close look at this at 9 a.m. In a few hours' time.
And speaking about the economy, so Job Street country manager Gan Bok Hum had said that there's a positive trend. Apparently, that there has been an increase in number of employers expected to make new hirings in the next 6 months. I think they found that 74% of employers were expected to make new hirings. Mm. And then they see that a lot of these jobs are actually in emerging IT roles, data analysts, AI, machine learning specialists, and so forth. But at the same time, they found that there's been a sharp drop in employees' quality of life since the MCO was introduced. Something like 44% of respondents reported themselves as being unhappy with their quality of life, and the most directly affected were the hospitality and catering employees, tourism and travel, media as well.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of conversation over the fact that, you know, the MCO and the economic crisis that has followed has really impacted not just the B40s, but the kind of the M40s as well, because the M40s tend to be the segment of the population that are more highly geared. You know, if you're servicing a housing loan as well as a car loan, perhaps multiple car loans, even a drop of 300-400 ringgit in your monthly salary can be devastating in the consequences that it will have on the quality of your life outside of once you've serviced your loan. So now that after the loan moratorium was put in place, I think people got a bit of a breather, but that moratorium is ending at the end of this month. So who knows how long it'll take before we really start to feel the pinch. Now, page two of the Star also has something on Airbnb here, kind of to bounce off that hospitality topic, Noel. The housing minister, Zuraida Kamarudin, has said that standardizations of several issues, including regulations, licensing, taxes involving the hotel sector as well as Airbnb, they're looking at finalizing this by the end of the year. I think definitely more than overdue. This has been something that the hotel industry has called for quite a while now, and Airbnb has indicated that it is amenable to discussing with the government and to perhaps looking at how they're going to standardize and bring themselves in line with the overall government tax structure. But it's still very up in the air.
And if we take a look at a bit earlier, towards the end of last week, actually, more Muda-linked news. It looks like the EC has said that we should be seeing automatic registration of voters by June 2021. I think the rollout should start by then. And I mean, there's a bit of a wide range of how many new voters this would bring in, right? So Deputy Chairman Azmi Shahrom has said that about 15 million registered voters in the country and approximately 4 million potential voters above the age of 21 who are not registered to vote. So we are looking at 4 million out of 15 million. That's a significant number and a significant jump from 15 to 19. But that's if everyone votes and everyone registers. So automatic registration would increase the count there. But whether everyone shows up to the polls whenever the election happens, that's another big question.
Absolutely. And of course, the youth vote is also increasingly in the spotlight, particularly with the Sabah state elections that are going to be happening this Saturday. And we're going to be looking at it in more detail later on at about 7:45 with Dr. Oi San, Senior Fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. So if you're interested, please come check it out, or you can find the podcast later on this afternoon. But right now, we have the 7 o'clock news bulletin coming up for you. But first, Use Me by Bill Withers, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.